Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 277. Cetshwayo Kampani visits Queen Victoria as Britain fractures the Zulu Kingdom. There's a link between Afghanistan and Zululand. When Cetshwayo Kampani was captured after the Anglo-Zulu War, he was ferried to Cape Town. His countenance was one of dignity, but that is difficult to maintain in the face of terrible seasickness. The Zulu king had made it known that he was afraid of the sea, and his nervousness compounded his queasiness. The five-day voyage from Port Durnford, modern-day Richards Bay, to Simonstown was torture for the king. He and at least five wives who had joined him in captivity were ensconced in a hut that had been erected for him on the poop deck, from where he watched the activities on the shore in Cape Town for almost a week before he disembarked. As he observed all the ships, the developments on the coast, it became apparent that his attempt at fighting the powerful British Empire had always been doomed. When he eventually stepped from the skiff onto Cape Turf, his appointed custodian, Captain J. Ruscombe Poole of the Royal Navy, escorted the Zulu King from Simonstown. Like Nelson Mandela's minders, much later, Captain Ruscombe Poole was a sympathetic jailer, so too the King's interpreter, Henry Longcast. Henry was an Irish orphan who'd been brought up at the Quamagwaza mission station, and he had known Cetshwayo since he was a child. An odd relationship developed between these men. Longcast was a straightforward, honourable man and became Cetshwayo's advisor, never betraying the Zulu king's trust. Joining Cetshwayo in exile was Mkosana Kasakana, formerly one of Mpani's councillors. Three other attendants were at hand, including the royal hairdresser and four young women of royal standing, as well as a female servant. They were first to spend time in the Flagstaff Bastion of the 17th century castle in Cape Town, where they were allotted a suite of apartments and a parapet for daily walks. Throngs of what we call day trippers in Victorian times, we would describe them as tourists, gathered to catch a glimpse of the Zulu king on the heights of the castle. The British then erected boards on the sides of the parapet to provide the king with some privacy. While imprisoned, he was in control of who he allowed to come and go. Those who did make it through the vetting process were amazed at Cetshwayo's dignity. He radiated a sense of presence. Cape politicians came to pay their respects, so too visiting royalty like Princess Albert and George, Queen Victoria's grandsons, talk about them in a moment, and other committed Zulu-files like Lady Florence Dixie. Back in Zululand, Sir Garnet Wolseley had been fashioning together a new Zulu system. It resembled the system of what the British were trying to impose on Afghanistan. There, Lord Lytton was trying to secure the northwest frontier of India, what is now Pakistan, by breaking Afghanistan into a number of impotent principalities. The local princes, who were sympathetic to British control, would be handed the levers of power. Wolseley wanted to secure the safety of Natal and the Transvaal by fragmenting the Zulu kingdom in the same way. Sir Theophilus Shepstone was the go-to once more, along with ex-Cape Native Affairs Secretary Charles Brownlee and the Commissioner Sir Henry Bulwer. Shepstone's main aim was to destroy the power of the Zulu royal family. He believed it was fragile anyway. This was a miscalculation. Cetshwayo may have been in exile, but the concept of political power in Zululand was well and truly in the hands of the extended royal family. 13 chiefs should be nominated, said Shepstone, each independent of the other, but utterly dependent on the British. Royal influence would be stifled, he thought. Some of these 13 were hereditary, linked to the royal family, but they were considered rebels or independents. Others had no blood ties to the family at all. But all owed their power to the British and would collaborate to crush any Zulu phoenix rising from the dust. Former Zulu chief John Dunn emerged as an important advisor, so too Theophilus Shepstone's brother John. As these men went about their designs, they were most critically aware of the frontier zones, the chiefdoms close to the borders of Natal and the Transvaal. These would be buffer zones against the chiefdoms to the northeast. Over many generations, tension, conflict and mishap had characterized the relationship between the Zulus of the east and the Batlokwa people, who lived close to the Drakensberg. Their chief Klubi was Sotho speaking, and he was handed the all-important and verdant area at the junction of the Tugela River and the Umsinyati, the buffalo. The British were to set off an internecine conflict here that rumbles on to this day. As with their machinations in Afghanistan, by disrupting the order of the clans, the effect was not to increase stability but to decrease it. The northwest frontier of India was home to Muslims who had relatives on both sides of the mountainous divide into Afghanistan. As with the Pakistan of today, instability continues in this notorious region. It's amazing how decisions taken so long ago continue to buffet our lives, whether in Afghanistan or the Upper Tugela. As Chief Hlubi of the Batlokwa slipped into something more comfortable, malignant eyes narrowed. The two princes, Machanas, and the senior chief, Sihayo, had been pushed aside, cast aside. If you cast your mind back 10 episodes, you'll remember Chief Sihayo well. It was his son who had crossed into Natal and killed the two unfaithful wives, and it was Chief Mnyamana who had seized all his cattle as punishment. Sihayo had not caused the Anglo-Zulu War. The British were itching to rid themselves of Cetshwayo, but Sihayo's act was seized upon by authorities as the spark. Mnyamana, by the way, was to reject Wolseley's nomination as one of these 13 chiefdoms, an act that he would later regret, as you'll hear in later podcasts. In a strange twist of fate, Wolseley gave the chieftainship to Nchingwayo, the man who'd led the Zulu to victory over the British at Isandlwana. Chief Sihayo was now destitute. Wolseley sent another chief, Manyonyoba, to set up his homestead near Sihayo's great abandoned place, Sokeke, increasing the humiliation. Chief Hlubi's promotion was a bit like taking a mid-level businessman from Belgium and making him a lord in one of the English counties. He didn't speak the language properly, he looked different, dressed different, and was, to be quite blunt, an alien. It would not do, and didn't. Nominating John Dunn was a bit of a conundrum. Here was a former chief linked to the Zulu royal family, a man who had deserted Cetshwayo on the eve of war, placed in a position of power. He was terrified of Cetshwayo being allowed to return, all the more so because Wolseley gave Dunn his land back in southeast Zululand. Then Wolseley gave him more, stretching all the way from the Tugela River, running north along the coastal lowlands past modern-day Richards Bay and up the Tugela all the way to the headwaters. Much further north in Afghanistan, Lord Lytton, the British Viceroy of India, had envisaged Kandahar province as the bulwark against the rebellious tribes of Afghanistan and the wild mountains of northwestern India. The British defeated Afghanistan's leader Sher Ali Khan in the war between 1878 and 1880. Lytton's vision involved separating key regions and strengthening frontier zones that could be more easily influenced from India. In this thinking, Kandahar mattered enormously. It sat astride the routes connecting southern Afghanistan to the approaches toward the Indian subcontinent. It linked trade and military corridors running west towards Persia and north towards central Afghanistan. Fast forward nearly a century to the Soviet-Afghan War in 1979. The Soviet intervention revived many of the same geographic realities. Kandahar again became essential because whoever controlled it controlled southern movement corridors, the supply routes from neighboring regions, and access to the Pashtun heartland. As usual, geography worked against them. Vast rural spaces, cross-border movement, and local power networks made control extraordinarily expensive. They were roundly defeated by the Taliban and pulled out in 1989. Then came the post-2001 era. For both the NATO coalition and forces from countries including the US and UK, Kandahar once again emerged as the strategic center of gravity in the south. Kandahar was persistently violent from the mass casualties of Maiwand in the 1880s through Soviet counterinsurgency campaigns to the IED wars of the 21st century. The province repeatedly converted military occupation into prolonged attritional conflict. European, Russian, and American empires came and went, but Kandahar remains a symbol of the incredible tenacity of the Afghanis. So too with our tale here in South Africa. The use of buffer zone logic was going to backfire. In the Middle Tugela region of Zululand, for example, the Middle Drift, as it was known, Chief Makondo the Magwaza was recalcitrant, ignoring British orders. In September 1879, Wolseley sent Dunn and hundreds of troops to march around the Middle Tugela, intimidating all chiefs into surrender, and Dunn made Godide, Mavumbingwana, Kuteka and Sigananda principal chiefs under his control there. Of all the machinations after this war, that actually made sense. It perpetuated existing local power networks. North of the Black Mfulosi, Cetshwayo's heartland, the people called themselves the Usutu, the Zulu's war cry, and the war cry of the royalist Xolisi. Yeah, Wolseley wisely selected chiefs of great status to lead, including Hamu, who had crossed over to the British side late in the Anglo-Zulu War. The British commander then adjudicated in the long-running dispute between the Zulu and the Transvaal. He made the northern limits of Hamu's territory the Bevani River and gave Sekhetwayo up to the Pemivana River. This meant the entire disputed territory between the confluence of the Pongola and Bevani, including the Ntombi Valley and Lunenburg, was now handed over to the Transvaal. Cetshwayo Kompany had struggled for decades to stop this from happening, but he was in exile far away in the Cape and unaware at this point about just how his land was being divvied up. With the deals struck and the boundary lines drawn, Sir Garnet Wolseley undoubtedly stood over his field maps, dusting the ink from his hands, looking suitably satisfied. On paper, it was a masterpiece of imperial economy. By breaking the defeated Zulu kingdom into 13 separate, artificially manufactured chiefdoms, he believed he had neatly neutralized the royal house of Cetshwayo without costing the British treasury a single extra pound for formal annexation. But it was a spectacular act of hubris. In his eagerness to play the ultimate arbiter of power, Wolseley had created a political vacuum, not a peace. By elevating volatile opportunists and historic rivals, he had effectively built a house of cards. Unbeknownst to him, as he packed away his maps, this clinical exercise in divide and rule was destined to backfire. He hadn't stabilized the frontier. He had merely engineered a slow-burning fuse that would soon detonate into a brutal, fratricidal civil war. The kingdom was not destroyed, and more importantly, considering the carnage to come, it still had energy to fight. The influence of the chiefly class was undisturbed. Only the king's power itself was eliminated. The royal house was curtailed, but not dispatched. The Zulu idea of themselves was shaken, not eviscerated, and remembered the very thing that made them whole. The royal chiefs were pragmatic and ambitious, but were not ready to create independent statelets out of themselves by castrating themselves for British interests. By now, Cetshwayo Kompany was technically free to return from exile once these arrangements had been made, but he first requested a meeting with Queen Victoria. He and his entourage had been moved from the castle to the Oudemolen estate, which has an amazing history. The story of Oudemolen is fascinating because it acts as a literal mirror to the layering of Cape history. The site is perched at the confluence of the Black and Lispiek rivers, which was a vital seasonal grazing ground for Khoi Khoi pastoralists and a deeply significant spiritual meeting point. When the Dutch East India Company arrived, they carved up this valley for agriculture, and in 1717, the colonial authorities needed to do something about their crude wooden windmills in Table Valley, which were being torn apart by the ferocious southeasterly winds. To solve this, they granted farmers land along the Black River to build a sturdier stone tower mill. Completed in 1718, it became South Africa's very first proper windmill, hence the name Oudemolen, Old Mill. The farm passed through various private hands over the decades, including prominent Cape families like the Mostarts and the Bums, before falling into neglect when steam-powered milling made windmills obsolete in the 1860s. Recognizing its isolation, the British colonial government bought the farm specifically to house high-profile political prisoners. Cetshwayo wasn't the only captive monarch to walk those grounds. The British also imprisoned the Amatlubi king, Langalibalele, on the adjoining farm called Eitvlucht. The two exiled kings, despite their historical rivalries back home, spent hours together at Oudemolen, taking long walks in the fynbos and hunting small game across the open fields that we now know as Pinelands. While the British officially turned Cetshwayo a state guest at Oudemolen to soften the reality of his captivity, it was an active military barracks. Yet his presence turned the old farm into an unexpected diplomatic hub. In 1881, Queen Victoria's young grandsons, Prince Albert Victor and Prince George, the future King George V, visited the Cape on a naval cruise. They had travelled out to Oudemolen specifically to meet the famous Zulu king, gifting him a silver-headed walking stick. Eventually, after Cetshwayo's departure and the shifting of the colonial frontier, the site took on a darker institutional life. In the early 20th century, the land was converted into the Falkenberg East Mental Health Facility, used to house black psychiatric patients. Today, the site has been reclaimed as the Odemolen Eco Village, a modern rustic micro-enterprise hub filled with organic gardens, artist workshops, and horse-riding paths, where the old farmhouse still stands as a monument to a crownless king who once walked its paths while plotting his return home. In August 1882, the Union Company's mail steamer SS Arab slipped through the grey, heavy mists of the English Channel and docked at Southampton. Stepping onto the deck was King Cetshwayo Khampande. Only 3 years earlier, he'd been the absolute ruler of the Zulu kingdom, the man whose impi had shattered imperial pride at Isandlwana before his capital at Ulundi had been burned to ash. He had endured exile and his stated terror of the sea, but had now crossed the Atlantic to look Queen Victoria in the eye. He wore tailored European suits and his isikotko, the polished traditional headring woven into his hair. The British public, who had been fed a steady diet of wartime propaganda framing him as a bloodthirsty despot, expected a monster. Instead, they found a tall, deeply dignified man whose composure completely disarmed them. Crowds mobbed his brick lodgings in Kensington just to catch a glimpse of the king waving from the window. The true climax of this surreal diplomatic mission came on August 14th at Osborne House on the Isle of Wight. There, Cetshwayo was granted an audience with Queen Victoria. Her advisers had begged her to remain aloof. After all, Cetshwayo's warriors had killed thousands of her soldiers. There was nervous anticipation on both sides. One of Cetshwayo's counselors revealed later that the Zulu king was trembling in trepidation before he'd been ushered into the queen's chambers. Yet, when the tiny Empress of India and the towering Zulu monarch finally stood face to face, the atmosphere was one of mutual respect. Queen Victoria was apparently spellbound by his quiet majesty. In her private journals, she would later note that she recognized him not as a savage, but as a great warrior and a brave enemy. The two exchanged portraits, and she presented him with a silver cup, a symbolic gesture of mutual esteem. Cetshwayo, for his part, never forgot a gesture, and presented the two young princes with two beautifully carved sticks made of mzimbiti, or ironwood, in return. Both Prince Albert Victor and Prince George had joined the Queen for this unique visit, and it was they, of course, who had gifted the King of the Zulus the silver-headed walking stick. For Cetshwayo, the meeting was a triumph of endurance. He extracted a promise from the Liberal government to support his reinstatement to the Zulu throne. It was not all as he had expected, however. When he finally boarded the SS Arab to head back across the ocean, he was returning to a Zululand that was going to treat him very badly indeed, as it subsided into one of the most tragic conflicts South Africa has ever experienced. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms, and you can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, Saligali.